Howdy, y'all. You're listening to The Managing Up Show, a podcast about leading and managing in the world of technology. I'm your host, Travis Weisgood, and with me this week is Brandon Hayes.
Hello. So this week, we had a topic that I'm sad Nick isn't able to join us, because I know he would have loved this too, but he is doing something exotic, I'm sure, at this point. I think he's either traveling to Europe or organizing closets. Who can say? But the thing that you brought up when we were talking about potential topics, and we have some listener suggestions that we're looking forward to talking about, but one that came up that really like kind of threw me for a loop was a term that you used that I want to make sure I get right. You mentioned a phrase that I couldn't get out of my head, and I think it was tactical tornadoes. And I wanted to first and foremost know about that. But the idea that generally is talking about strategic thinking versus tactical thinking, execution mode stuff, and how to balance those on teams, and when we kind of get wrapped up in those. And then I just heard the term tactical tornadoes, and I wanted you to explain that to me.
Yeah, so a tactical tornado, it can refer to a team. More often than not, it refers to a person. And this is a person that outside of the engineering or technology team tends to be looked on with awe. Because it's the thing that like, man, wouldn't it be great if we had an event system that powered a workflow engine as just some random throwaway comment. And 2 weeks, 2 days later that afternoon sometimes, this person comes back with, hey, look what I just did. And it's this whole system that they've just like thrown together. And for the use case that they tested on or that they built for, it works. But they haven't thought about any of the broader implications of that code. So I first came across that term while reading a book by, I believe it's a Stanford professor, but the book is titled A Philosophy of Software Design. And it's actually a textbook, although it's a very engaging textbook, and one that I'd encourage you to read if you're interested in software design. But he spends a lot of time in the book talking about the differences of strategic programming versus tactical programming. And a little bit of time on kind of the place of where both of them fit in. But at the extreme end of the tactical programming is the tactical tornado. And they are the person who is cutting every corner, throwing things together to make something work. And the aftermath is kind of like a tornado. I mean, if you think about it, if you're thinking about wind power, like let's say you're building wind turbines, having wind is a really good thing. Tornadoes give you a lot of wind. They might tear down your turbines, but they'll give you a lot of wind concentrated in one area. And if you're not familiar with software design and solid software practices, from the outside, you see a thing that like, hey, that whole section of the application didn't exist this morning or last week. Now it does. This person's amazing. And they tend to get a lot of praise outside that. As a leader in an engineering organization, that's the thing you got to caution against, because it's really easy for a CEO or even a VP of product to see all of that output and be like, we need everybody to work like that. And it's like, okay, so what's the half-life of our company? Like, when can we die? Because if we do this, we will. Hey, if we're only going to be around for 6 months or a year or 18 months, great. That's fine. A really good example of this, I was listening to the CTO of Obama for America's 2012 campaign talking about, what was it? Was it Orca? Oh, I forget the name of the project they had, but they had some project that got a lot of buzz about how they were building this API first platform to build all of their infrastructure for the election on. And it was modeled after Facebook and their API. I don't know if you remember going back to like 2010, Facebook released their Swift project prior to the Swift programming language. That was their new API first system, and it was going to be great. And it quietly just kind of went away. Well, this guy knew some people over at Facebook, and he's like, hey, I want to talk to you about this because this is what I'm doing. Like, how did this work? How did this scale? And they're like, oh, it fell underneath its own weight. And they're like, huh? I was like, oh yeah, eventually it just gets too complex and you can't deal with it. And we had to walk it back and not use that anymore. Oh, huh. Well, how long did it take you to do that? We figured for most projects, it was somewhere between like 18 and 20 months. And he was 17 months from election day. And he knew that come election day, all this software was just getting thrown out. So he made a tactical decision based on his strategy of, I have to keep the system running until election day. To say, I don't care if it can't scale for 18 months, it can scale for 17, which is what I need. Let's go down that path. If you're not thinking about the broader context of the code you're about to deploy and the broader context in how it's going to be deployed, you can kind of back yourself into that. And the tactical tornado can be a hindrance to that if you're not saying, okay, how do I harness this tornado and point it in the direction that I want?
Yeah. And harnessing a tornado, as we all know, is very easy.
Oh yeah. I mean, we've all seen the postcards of like those cowboys roping them.
Right. Pecos like Bill, right? That's the legend.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
So yeah, I think I've definitely seen this archetype play out in multiple different environments under very different circumstances from each other. In some places where the tactical tornado archetype person, this person that is just really focused on generating, I've seen it go really bad in different ways, and I've seen it go really well. Mm-hmm. And where it goes really bad is, like you said, when it's unharnessed, that energy is unharnessed and unrestrained. And what will happen is that person will create a ton of process debt, product debt, technical debt, because they're so fixated on executing against the, like, they basically gather enough context to go really fast in one direction. And then they just like, it's sort of like a drag racer, right? They don't care if the car could turn. Yeah. They just need to go 0 to 60 as fast as humanly possible. And that's what excites them. It's this raw sense of speed and productivity that makes them feel happy and fulfilled. And without that, they get frustrated. And so when you tell that person to pump their brakes and hey, I need you to hold up and do some research and care about all these various stakeholders and the organizational politics that go on to make the thing that you're doing feasible over the long term, like, they do not want to hear that. Mm-hmm. So I've seen that in one company go really badly because that got really overly rewarded. And then those people tend to actually have a shelf life in a company of about 18 months because they go, oh, I'm bored. Everything's getting so slow now. And it's like, that was you. You did that. You used up all the fastness. And they get bored and leave and they blame the company for it. And this isn't this has not come with judgment attached to it. This is, to me, mismanagement that created this mm-hmm. problem in the first place. And so this isn't me like blaming this person for creating the scenario, but I am saying it's short-sighted to like use up all the fastness early, leave and go do it again somewhere else, and then leave the team to clean up after you. Those people generally aren't there to clean up the mess that happens after. I've also seen it where that person meets a ton of internal resistance because the organization is like, not this again, not this person again, not this archetype again. And they resist and reject it. And that person goes, why can't I seem to get any of my ideas accepted? And mm-hmm. they're doing too much coding and not enough listening up front to environments like that. So depending on the environment, that could be overly rewarded or so under-supported that that person goes, I don't belong here. This isn't where I work. And the third type where I have seen it work is when they get harnessed to usually two other people, a person that's like the marketer of the group and the person that's the sort of hipster, the quality obsessed person of the group. And they form this like triangle of tension that one person is trying to, and the most important thing that happens in harnessing this person, in my experience, is that they are equally yoked to one or two other people that create a healthy tension because they co-own something together that they all care about. They mm-hmm. like, they all equally care about a result of some kind, like, hey, I want to do this and let's go really fast. And somebody goes, hold on. Like, who is this for? Why are we doing this? And somebody else goes, hold on. What are the long-term consequences that we are not paying attention to right now? What are some technologies that we haven't even looked at yet that could potentially solve this problem for us differently? So sort of like that. And I've heard this called the hipster hacker hustler triangle, where one person is thinking about like, why are we doing it? And that's totally my archetype. One person is thinking about, are we doing this with the right tools and to the right level of quality for long-term thinking or for the appropriate time frame of thinking? And then you have that other person who's like, look, just give me something to chew on, like throw work at me, it will get demolished. And I love those people. I love working with them. I loved being on teams with them. And if those people respect each other and share a goal, you can do some really cool stuff. But that tornado of a person, unchecked and insufficiently sort of, when the reward structures are set up to punish or reward them inappropriately for that behavior, and they're not sort of tied to any meaningful goal, boy, that just, I have to imagine you've seen that scenario play out badly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And generally, like, it plays out badly, and then there is a backlash one direction or the other. You see people, like, they go so process-oriented, everybody's afraid to do anything. Or nothing happens, we keep losing these really productive people. You've got to loosen it up. And that's followed by 6 months of buggy releases because they're just trying to get stuff out the door. There is one other possible scenario that I've seen this person work really well, although it's kind of a, it's almost a containment strategy for dealing with it. But like generally speaking, like the difference between those is that type of person and your normal, like measured type of person. I don't even want to say normal, the measured versus the tactical tornado, or we need something for strategic that would work and be slightly derisive towards this, somebody who's too strategic in their thinking. But the counter to that is to put them in a team that's very agency model focused. So that may actually be at an agency where literally getting something out as quickly as possible and getting those billable hours is the priority. And a lot of times people come from that background and they rebel against the every week it's a new priority depending on who's paying us enough to, I want to work on a product, but they don't know how to do that. But a really good place for that person could be like as a support engineer. And I don't mean that in like a, like doing customer support or something like that, but generally an engineer who is in service of a customer success or customer support team, where their whole purpose in life is to make sure that things that are a problem right now are not a problem as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
And it could be that their job is also teeing up work that gets pushed back over the fence to the rest of the engineering team to solve long-term, but there is a problem that exists today. How quickly can we make it not exist? And especially for somebody making the transition from a pure agency model into a product company, I feel like that can be a really good like gateway position for that. And I feel like there's a lot of junior developers who fall into this trap as well, because they don't have a broad enough context to be able to make strategic decisions. They're just like, well, this doesn't work. This does. Therefore, I'm going to do B. And it is a very tactical, keep going until true. Okay, now reset. Keep going until true. Yeah. Now reset. And that's not that's just a place that every developer goes through at some point in their career. But if you have too broad a scope in the things that you can impact without that external guidance of what's going on, that can definitely put you and the entire team in a bind down the road.
Yeah, I think what you're describing is sort of like the tactical tornado archetype likes to have an impact as quickly as possible and likes to see the impact of their work as quickly as possible. And what you want to do then, if you want to not have them change that about the way that they work, you limit their blast radius of things going wrong. And a really good way to do that is to put them in a situation where the number of customers is not very high because you're servicing internal people. The length of time things will stay broken is very low because those people will reach out and tell you it doesn't do what I need it to do. And the cost of things breaking is very low because like we didn't piss off and lose a customer. Employees have to use this software. And so like there's no meaningful financial consequence to bugs and visual fidelity loss or something like that. A lot of times, I would say a huge amount of the time with people that I would perceive to be like tactical tornado, the complaints I get back on their work is about they didn't pay attention to consistency and design with other parts of the system, whether it's like uniform API or it looks weird, you know, it looks janky in their stuff because they were so focused on making sure this works and moving on because they solved the hard technical problems. It's not interesting to move things 3 pixels this way and that so that it's, you know, using the same button styles as other parts of the application. And they don't want to sit around and wait for design reviews of stuff. Mm-hmm. But when you move into the larger space of applications that are used by a very large number of people, that visual inconsistency can actually get really expensive because customers go, oh, this is weird, I'm going to bounce. And they don't check out of your website, or they don't, you know, they don't do the thing that makes you the money, or they complain, or, you know, like that trust erosion that occurs from inconsistency suddenly costs you money. And so that's how process builds up around that. And suddenly there's a design review phase of every pull request. And there are, you know, API committees that approve changes to the public API and change logs you have to submit to. And this person goes, oh my God, I'm pulling my hair out. This is like not what I came here for.
Yeah.
And so you can ask them to adapt to that and try to find a way to be productive, or you can adapt the environment to them. And I guess I hadn't really thought of that. I was thinking about how to create a team that lets them adapt somewhat, but you're talking about creating an environment that is just tailored for that style. If a person is like really committed to that, like living on the edge lifestyle.
Yeah. Well, I've worked with developers in the past who have zero interest in product dev. They'll do it. Like you give them, here's a product spec, go build it, and they'll do it and it'll get done. But it's not what they're really passionate about. because I don't know if it's a procrastination thing, and I say that as a procrastinator, or if it's just a personality quirk, or exactly what's driving it. But they kind of need that fire of, oh, this has to be done in as quickly as possible. I've had people on my team before who, like, giving them a product thing and saying, okay, go spend the next 6 weeks to figure this out, is a big ask. And I know it's going to be a struggle for them. But that same person, I could say, this doesn't work. This is what it should do. It needs to do that as quickly as possible. And, like, they throw themselves into it for the next 30 minutes or 3 days, whatever it takes to make that happen. And they come out of it, like, completely drained and feeling amazing.
Yeah.
Because it's just their personality type. And again, as a self-admitted adrenaline junkie, I understand that as, like, that adrenaline rush you get of, this thing now works. So, like, maybe that's something that's feeding into it as well. But especially as a company grows and gets bigger and you have more and more types of roles, I definitely think there are places that you can carve out for a bunch of different types of people, both in isolation of, like, here's all of our agency people and they are working on the sales engineering side of this. And that is all they do, is things to support closing sales. And this is fast turn and it's going to change on a dime. And there, you're going to be able to hire into that. And it might be harder if you're a product company and traditionally hire product engineers to find somebody who's into that. But man, when you do, it's amazing to see that work. So I like your model as well, where you're like, okay, here's how we are organized as a team and as a company, and here's how we can balance it. Because that's the other thing. If you have everyone is thinking completely strategic and trying to figure out how they can code the next thing that's going to run without a reboot for 20 years, you're never going to get anything done.
Yeah. Have you ever had teams like that?
Yes. So that's the other end of this spectrum. And I haven't come across it in reading that book. I don't know if you'll ever get to the point of calling out, like, this is that the overthinker, but it's essentially the philosopher programmer, where all you do is think about the best ways to do this and the best ways to do that. And you can't actually get anything done because you're too focused on the correct way of doing things and the technically correct way of doing things rather than getting something done. And these are the people who will, if given the ability, will go develop 3, 4, 5 prototypes of the exact same thing, all using a completely different tech stack, and then run a full load test against it. Or if it's a UI framework that they're thinking about adopting, well, let's go code up this interface in Material Design and Bootstrap and Foundation, and let's just try doing one ourselves too, and, like, user test those to see how they work. It's that type of person who, as one former boss put it, has their heads in the clouds the whole time.
Yeah.
They're too focused on what could be to focus on what needs to happen right now in front of them.
Yeah, instead of, like, measure twice, cut once, they're measuring, like, 9 times and then not cutting anything.
Or they're measuring 9 times and then switching implements just to make sure. And let's also measure in metric and imperial and do the conversions. Let's just double check that we got this correct.
Because cutting is a big deal, everybody.
Yeah, once we cut.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, so that's, like, the opposite of the move fast and break things. I think there is a third archetype, which is the lazy one. And that's more my speed. Instead of, like, I have had friends that are just like, oh my gosh, just give me something to do and I'll do it. Just point me in a direction, give me problems and I'm going to chew through them. And I've had friends that are, like, super into quality and philosophy and all that stuff. And I actually like both of those things, but I would rather solve a project with no code if possible. And so, like, there's like a third archetype here where there's, like, I am so fixated on the problem to be solved at hand that I'm looking for, okay, what's a way through here that's the least liability, the least amount of time to solution, the least cost of ownership possible. And and I think that isn't always the right answer, because, like, I don't really, it doesn't give me a quality focus. It doesn't give me a chew through problems focus. It's more about, like, I don't know what you would call that, but it's like, let's just, like, why are we doing this again? Do we actually need to do this? Why are we writing this test again? What is this thing testing? I mean, we've been banging our heads on this test for, like, an hour. Is this that valuable? Like, why are we doing this? And sometimes those challenges are really valuable, and sometimes they're a big fat waste of time, and sometimes they're demoralizing. And so I have to be careful about, like, that, bringing that to the table. But as far as, like, the archetype of, I want to come back to your archetype of the head in the clouds person.
Well, I don't want to leave your archetype just yet, because I think this is a very important archetype. And this is one that, as somebody who can transition from Tactical Tornado to Software Philosopher and back and forth, that's a role that I often find myself having a hard time with. And I would straight up put that as the pragmatic programmer, and like put the trademark after it if you want, because I think this is a Dave and Andy approved thing. A pragmatic programmer, by their estimation, would not write code if it wasn't needed. If it wasn't necessary. Like, they understand the cost of ownership of every line of code that they write, and they're going to write as few of them as they possibly can. And I have more than once caught myself 3 hours into tackling, how do I get this tested? How do I make these tests work correctly? And realize, I could just turn this test off. This test isn't actually necessary. It's not testing logic that is like uncomplicated. All the other pieces are tested. So I don't really need to test this thing that you can look at and see the API calls that it makes and know that those are tested. So I think that's a very important person to have in the mix. And I think as an engineering leader, it's very important to try to be that check yourself. Because I view that as like transcending the other two. And it kind of brings them together into the into focus. What are the tactics we should employ? What are the philosophies that should guide us as we apply those tactics? And do we need to do any of that? Like, that's kind of the third piece. And that's like, that's very often the piece that's missing in any work, and probably the hardest part of running any sort of software project or product company, is ensuring that you did ask the question, do we need to do this? And do we understand why we need to do this?
It's funny, because I think those three archetypes actually map to the three archetypes from the E-Myth Revisited. Did you ever read that book? Like, from,
no.
It's from like back in the day.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
This is like .com 1.0 stuff. But I read it, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. And it kind of, some of it kind of stuck with me. And it really, the thing that stuck with me about it is those three archetypes don't describe three people. They describe three modes. Mm-hmm. And in the book, he talks about them and describes them as entrepreneur, manager, and technician, where one of them is focused on the how, the manager's kind of focused on the what, or maybe the who, and the entrepreneur is focused on the why. Mm-hmm. And actually, we all have each of those modally in us. And if you're going to be an entrepreneur, you have to figure out a way to tailor the stuff that you have to do for those modal states that you find yourself in. And I kind of like that idea that it's not so much making sure that you properly categorize a human being and make sure that they fit into one box or the other. It's that, hey, we all have these modes. Now, some of them may be more comfortable or more dominant, but it doesn't mean you couldn't tease some of this other capability out of somebody else, especially depending on what they want to do. As a manager, if they're like, yeah, I want to start a business someday, and they're like, just this execution tactical tornado, you're like, wow, that is not the right track for you. Like, you're going to have to, you know, build up some other muscles. So it's pretty contextual, but it this industry tends to over, like, in the certainly in the startup phase, where the projected life cycle of a person's engagement with your company is 18 months. The life cycle of a startup company is 18 to 36 months. So it's like your reward system is going to bias toward these tactical focused people and away from these analytical types.
Something I want to dig into there a little bit, and we've kind of hinted at it coming up to this point, is the idea of what are the costs associated with any of these types of individuals, and like having that pendulum swing too far one way or the other. And I think in the life cycle of particularly a startup, but I would say this is even as part of a life cycle of a new team working inside a larger organization, early on, all of your priority is focused around like the existential problem. The proving to the world, whether that the scope of that world is the market or your company, like why you should exist. And the quickest way to do that is to show some sort of value. And the quickest way to show some sort of value for software developers is generally to develop some software that solves a problem. And you build a culture of rewarding that. And what happens is some corners get cut. Something goes out without a test. It's like, that's fine. I'm going to remember that edge case there. It will be fine. And you move on. And you're just a little bit off to the edge of where ideal would be. You're 1% off. And the next time you do the same thing, and you keep slightly moving 1% off to the side, and you end up in this scenario where now you started, you're heading straight in front of you 100 yards, and now you've gone 100 yards, but you're also off to the side 50. And please don't do the math on that, because I'm sure that's actually wrong. Although it's some, like, you got to figure out the units of measurements between here and 100 yards, and I'm sure you could get it to work out.
The compounding interest of 1%, I don't want to get into that. Yeah.
Yeah. But you end up off to the side, and you've done all of this work, but you've gotten off to the side. And the problem at that point, you look up and you're like, okay, we want to do this other thing that is totally in line with where the original vision was. And you've done all of this work towards the original vision, and you've shipped code towards that original vision. But now you come back and like, okay, now we need to get over here. And you're like, well, wait, no, we got to build a bridge, and we've got to do all these other things to get back over to that other place. And what I see happen more often than not, you've had these reward mechanisms from teams that were founded in a very lean, scrappy way to get something done. And they want to move forward on it. And they have, they've executed, and they've done the best to their capabilities and the guidance and context that they had when they were doing that execution. But now they're off to the side of where everybody, and I'm using air quotes there, outside the team thought they should be. And now there's all of this quote unquote technical debt. And I've seen this play out so many times in startups where you're exiting out of that, what are we going to be when we grow up, into the growth stage. And you're like, but we've got all this technical debt we've got to figure out. We're losing all these developers because they're so tired of working in this system that's too slow to work on. And then there's the backlash. And I've seen this happen anywhere from 18 months into a startup to being 5 or 6 years into a startup. And there's this backlash against that, let's execute, let's execute, let's execute. And at this point, they're like, okay, now we've got to actually clean up our technical debt. And now your incentives realign around potentially the other extreme, which is, well, let's make the correct choice. Let's develop the right thing. And now you get into this mode where all you're thinking about is, okay, I'm about to commit this code. How is it going to work for the next 3 years? And the thing that's so interesting, and the thing that can pause any executive inside or outside of an engineering team, or any engineer when they ask that type of question, well, what's the long-term impact of this going to be? Okay, well, define long-term. Well, the next 3 years. How long have you been a company? Well, 5. So you're talking, how is this going to affect the next 60% of the length of your company? Like, you're asking the wrong question. And it's almost always a backlash to too tactical of a conversation. And if that goes unchecked, what I've seen happen time and time again is you go into too much of a strategic conversation. Like, if you're rolling out code, if you are a payment provider like a Visa or a MasterCard or somebody like that, and when you do a deploy, you literally affect a large chunk of the world's population and their ability to send money, you might want to think about the implications of what you're doing. If you're changing the placement of a button or adding a new checkbox to a form that affects a few thousand people. Now, as long as that's not the checkbox to turn on and off a pacemaker or something like that, like, as long as you know the context and the context is not huge, it's probably not the same. You don't need that same level of rigor in your approach. There's a great, I don't remember who the comic is that does this. I'll bet you'll remember it as I'm describing it, but there's a comic that went around late 2000s, early 2010. And it was kind of like a Dilbert-ish type, like, corporate-y thing. And designer comes in and they're like, here's the new system we've designed. Here's the new button that we've got. And it's the new corporate blue. And somebody in the thing goes, well, shouldn't we test the blue? I read that Google tests 50 shades of blue or whatever, however many shades of blue. I'm like, okay, so this is how long it's going to take and how much money it would cost to do that. And the next paint is, I love that color blue. But very often there's not somebody to say, this is the cost of what you're about to do, because they're coming from that position of, well, we need to solve the process. So let's add the process. Let's add the reviews. Let's add the A/B testing. Let's add the user testing. And they add all these things on and they just build up this morass of process around what was a really loose project. And we get to that place you were talking about where the developer leaves pulling their hair out. I can't ship anything, but I've seen it go in kind of both of those directions.
Yeah, I think you're describing that life cycle really well.
Well, I joined a team and I came in as the first external, like, engineering leader to be hired into the team. And they had gone through the backlash a year and a half prior to my actually joining. And that was, they had no normal release cycles. They had no official QA process. There was no official sign off. Things shipped when they were ready to ship. And sometimes they might ship daily. Sometimes it might be a month or two between a release. It was just whenever anything was ready. They brought in somebody to run the scrum teams, like set up scrum, to bring in people and coach them on being scrum masters, to get people certified to be scrum masters, really rigorous on the process. And there was a very defined, like the Jira boards were 7 or 8 columns long with all the process. So you had like the to-do column, the doing column, and then everything else after that was just sign-offs of various states. And during my tenure there, there was a production outage, like a straight up, the database was falling over production outage. No connections were being served. The mobile app and the website were dead. Like, this is just not working. And I found this out in the worst possible time. I had just got on the road and was driving into work. I'm like, okay, well, thankfully I'm not leaving at peak time, so I'll be in the office in 20 minutes. I'll give them 20 minutes to figure out what's going on, and I'll arrive and reassess at that point and figure it out. And I had a meeting in like 45 minutes, though. So it's like I had to be there. So in the car, I hit back and I'm like, okay, update me. What's going on? And they had identified the problem. They had identified what they thought might be a fix. It wasn't a for sure thing yet, but it might be a fix. And we're starting to open pull requests for review. These were not boxes where we had a one-way deploy from a CI environment where like it's immutable infrastructure and the only way to get a deploy was to go through the process.
No, of course not. These are lovingly handcrafted artisanal AMIs.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Thankfully, they were AMIs and not some Linode instance or something like that. Nothing against Linode. I have had Linode servers in the past. I love Linode. Don't take that as hated for Linode. But like these were machines that any developer could SSH into. And I was like, why aren't we deploying it? Well, we haven't had it reviewed yet. I'm like, the site is down. Yeah, but like nobody's reviewed it. And I'm like, will this work? Has somebody looked over your shoulder and said, do you think this will work? Yeah. I'm like, okay, you start at server 1. I'll start at server 10. Let's meet in the middle. SSH in, make the changes, reboot the box, like go through that process. There was the break glass in case of emergency situation.
Yeah, you realize that this is to avoid the worst case scenario of an outage, which is now occurring.
Yes, but they had spent at this point, they're probably a year and a half, almost 2 years into the process backlash of we have to have a process, that it never even entered their mind that they could SSH into a box and make a change and restart the server and it would work. And like that literally was all that needed to happen. Within 5 minutes, we were back to normal, serving all requests and everything was fine. It was like, okay, now let's go through the process. Let's do a review. Let's do a full regression on this to make sure that it works. But the system is functioning more than it was a little while ago. And like that's an instance where a very tactical mindset is needed. The tactics are, we are drowning right now. How do we not drown anymore? How do we serve requests that are coming in? And if you think through the strategic mindset of, well, we want to make sure that we deliver quality software and that it's properly reviewed and that no regressions are introduced to the users. Okay, let's spend 4 hours and wait for all of those reviews and the continuous integration server to do its thing and all of that to happen. Let's wait for that. Or we could just SSH into these boxes and make the change. And I think that is the problem. And I think this is the challenge for a leader who finds themselves managing on either side of that scenario. And I think that like both of these are bad scenarios. The one where you have the team or individuals who are being rewarded for just throwing stuff against the wall and making it work, or the team who's being rewarded for adhering to the process and only shipping things through the process. Either one of those are the extremes.
And honestly, you're probably over-indexing on both in certain areas.
Absolutely.
At any given time.
Absolutely.
So you're probably overvaluing tactical, reward in some areas, and you're probably overvaluing strategic, planning in other areas. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of examples, but it's often like there may be an overreward on, hey, we just got to get this thing out. We're, marching toward this deadline. We're going to just try to like finish out as much of this API and UI stuff as we can. Meanwhile, like there may be this major initiative on infrastructure happening that's like, oh, no, but version 2.0 is going to come out and we're going to spend like 6 months strategizing about it before we do anything. And mm-hmm. There's got to be a way to... When I say there's got to be a way, that's a little bit of a leading question because I know there are books and books and books about this. But like, like knowing that anybody listening to this is probably in a situation where, like, I would say there's probably a 75% chance the person listening to this is managing in an environment where they're paying off some of the consequences of early stage, like tactical tornado reward system. And now teams are in the overcorrection curve of adding a bunch of process around stuff and frustrating some people. That seems to be more typical in my experience, that because like you exist in that state for longer than you exist in the time where if you're at a young startup, you're probably in the early hyper reward for just raw output stage. What do you do if you find yourself in that situation? Like, how do you walk that line? How do you bridge that gap? How do you correct those reward structures? Is it like, is it the job of a manager? Is there something bigger that has to be done? Are you just sort of like mitigating the consequences of that? Or is there stuff that you could actually do?
So I hate this answer, but I really think it depends. A lot of it is like, what is your role in the organization? So is your title engineering manager and you are leading all of engineering and are functioning as a VPE or de facto CTO? If that's the situation, then yes, I think that squarely falls on your shoulders. If you're a line level manager with a director or VP above you, I think it's on them to push that at an organizational level. And I think that, and to some extent, it's your responsibility to ensure that they understand those implications if they don't. If they don't, you have a lot of not managing up so much as coaching up to do at that point. Yeah, need to figure out how to upgrade that particular part of your upper management team to make sure that they're able to make those cases for you. But you need to do as much as you can to enable that and to supply ammunition for that so that they're able to communicate more broadly to the rest of the organization. And this is I think, so if your job as an engineering leader of some sort in your organization is to communicate to the rest of the organization what's happening. So sort of that like startup, like you're the first manager / directory type person who's been brought in. Yeah, it's your responsibility to make sure the rest of the organization understands the implications of both ends of that spectrum and where you exist on that spectrum right now. Like, the number of CEOs that I've talked to who don't understand software development as a whole because they're non-technical and have never had somebody explain to them the various modes of operation that can happen, it's illuminating when they have those conversations like, oh, okay, I totally understand this. And generally, they'll start throwing out references from their area of expertise, whatever part of the company that's in, explaining how they've seen that play out and where that gets messy for them. One that I've seen a lot is on the sales side. You got a very sales-focused CEO. And oh, this is the salesperson who said yes to everything and then came back and said, so this is what I sold. Like, that's the equivalent of a tactical tornado in a sales team.
Yes, absolutely.
But there's the inverse of that, which is the, well, I think maybe we could do that. Let me consult. And like, they're really standoffish and they're not willing to engage with the conversation and try to find that common ground because there's probably somewhere in the middle of those two of, no, we can't do it. And oh yeah, sure, we can do it. But they're so standoffish that they make the customer skittish because they're too focused on that. And I've seen salespeople who get really skittish after they get torn down a notch or two.
Yeah, they get
after promising
too
much.
Yeah.
So it's kind of that making sure that you can explain what's happening to those around you and the rest of the organization and help them see where you're at and what the implications are. And like, that's a really good conversation to have. And it's one of those like very frank conversations that I've had many times with the business side of organizations where it's like, yes, we can do it. And here are the implications of what we're going to do if we do that.
Yeah.
And like, I've had this conversation with product managers around the, I want to run the teams like this. It's like, okay, that's great. But if you want to queue up a Jira board as if it was like a list of receipts going across to the short order cooks list, and they're just doing what they're told and moving on, probably shouldn't be using this expensive of an engineering team.
Right.
We can get that a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
So like, it's having those conversations and not being afraid of like, backing down from those and like making sure they understand the context of what they're asking for.
Yeah. I think to say it another way, I think job one is assessment. Like, your job as a manager is to honestly and with some amount of expertise assess the situation. Mm-hmm. And I have a very strong bias because I really think this works. I have a strong bias toward team design as the like foundational unit of creating a result. I think team design is way under indexed, way undervalued in this industry, that you design a team to function a certain way, that you kind of know, if I put a group of people like this together, it's not that any one of them is the superstar. It's that when a team like this comes together and they're given the resources to do something and they're given a compelling vision, that they will kind of hammer out their differences over the course of a little bit of time and then navigate toward that solution. Mm-hmm. And they have everything that they need to sort of put the proper tension in between each other to not over index in one way or another. But you have to do that assessment first and say, wow, we have a team that's comprised of people that right now, for whether this is external structures or internal tendencies of the team, really strongly prefers to deliver rapidly and even before they have all the information. Mm-hmm. Or I have a team that really prefers to have all the information in the world before they pull the trigger and execute on something. And again, mm-hmm. I don't know if that's external pressure because they've been bit before and now we have all this, your job is to assess the internal and external factors of the team to correctly diagnose the situation. If you feel like it's pulling too hard in one direction or the other, and then ask, one of the questions is what are those external pressures and work? And like you said, coach up. But one of them is like, okay, what is the composition of this team? Mm-hmm. Is there a way we could potentially is this the right composition for a team? If I have five people that all only value this one thing, that this team kind of created a gravity and they interviewed people that were and preferred people that were like them because they didn't have guidance on team design. Like, you might have to shake that up a little bit instead of asking people to be different at a fundamental level. I would say 7 times out of 10, maybe more, it's external pressures that have kind of created that culture on the team. Mm-hmm. And your job is to make it clear, hey, this is, this is where we're tending toward. And this is what this business actually needs, and to create the space upwards for them to say, mm-hmm. hey, no CEO is ever going to tell you, what I wish? I wish the team would slow down, ship less, ship a little bit less so they could ship at higher quality. Like, nah, it's probably not going to happen. You're probably going to be the person having to push for that.
Yeah, but I also have heard that.
Have you really?
Yeah.
I always hear faster, faster, faster.
Well, it's with the caveat, I guess. Like, they do want faster, but they definitely don't want prod going down on a regular basis.
Okay, fair enough.
So, you get burned by that enough. Like, that is the dark place that you go down this path. And generally, what triggers the backlash? Like, it's enough egg on your face when you're sitting in a client's office pitching them this new product that you've got, or this new feature, or trying to get more of their company on your product. And they look up from their phone and be like, so you're down. Like, if no engineer has actually gone through that, where they're dealing with a customer and had an outage that customer was affected by while you are literally sitting in their office, that is a beyond soul crushing experience when that happens.
Yeah.
And if that costs you a deal, you will do whatever you think is reasonable, maybe even not reasonable, to try to avoid that scenario in the future. So I have seen teams say, hang on, slow it down. This norm can't exist, because every CEO will say, if all they're doing is shipping things that are broken or work halfway and half the users it's broken for, that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And this is the other thing, every CEO is going to say, how quickly can you get this done? Not how quickly can you do this correctly? How quickly can you get this done? And every CEO, with a caveat, worth anything, is asking you to tell them that answer, not the answer that they want to hear. And they're going to grumble and they're going to say, oh, you mean I can't have it? I can't have it in 3 weeks instead of 4 weeks. Like, whatever it is that they're going to grumble about, they're going to grumble about. But that's also their job, to make sure that they're pushing as hard as they can. But they're also, again, the caveat, good ones, reasonable ones, they're going to do this within a certain amount of reasonableness.
Yeah.
The really aware ones will walk into that and recognize the power dynamic that they've walked into when they have that CEO or co-founder in their title, and will say, here's something I've heard recently, actually. Here's the date we need to ship a demo by. I'm not telling you what I need you to ship by that date. I'm saying, this is the date. Now you come back and tell me what we can ship. Now here's all the things I'd love to have. And I'm going to be amazed if I get all of these and even more. But it's more important that you tell me what it is that can reasonably be promised in this time frame, so that we're making it an accurate promise. That takes a pretty high EQ to realize that you need to say that. And I think as an engineering leader, line manager all the way up, when you're going to a team and saying, hey, here's something that we have an estimate. There's a hard deadline, or there's a hard feature set. Like when any one of those, the triangle is immovable. If you go in and say, okay, here are the things that are immovable. Here are the things that are movable. And I need you to tell me how we make this work and what are the constraints. So if we have to ship these features, tell me, is it going to take 6 months or 6 weeks or 2 years? But I need you to tell me that. If the data is immovable, okay, tell me what the scope is of what we can actually deliver so that we all feel comfortable that we're on the same page. But calling out that thing and setting up the expectation where that's rewarded so people understand that safety, this was a legit thing. Because I've also seen that used very deviously where it was set up. Just tell me what you want, what you can do, and that'll be fine. And it was really a setup.
Yeah.
And you get to the end of it and it's like, hey, no, this isn't everything we needed. We needed all these other things. We're like, no, you said.
Yeah. You have to clear that contract up real early.
Yeah.
Like, okay, here's what's going in. And I hate having to do that. I hate having to like lock that down early where you're sort of getting prescriptive about what does and doesn't go in. But I have learned that people will just remember what they want to remember. If you don't mm-hmm. actually write something down and say, okay, here's what we agreed to. Yep. And so I think like you were saying, it is some of that is in identifying the goal and where the constraints are. And I guess what I'm saying is as a manager, if you're managing engineers or an engineering team, you're always going to flex on the least visible thing. And the least visible thing that in all of this is, well, there's two ways to do this. One of them is faster and the other one is more robust. And that's almost always going to be true. One of them is more robust because we put more thought into what the, you know, potential consequences are. We wrote more tests around it. We built it in a way that's more flexible instead of just sort of put the duct tape version that basically bolts on a thing into a thing it wasn't intended to do. So we bolted it onto a thing that does something similar, but really shouldn't have done that. But it was basically, you know, took one day instead of 8 days to do. And we know we're making this trade-off right now, those things happen invisibly. And the job of a manager is to make the invisible visible in those cases mm-hmm. and say, here are the actual trade-offs that exist to be made and give the team room to make those trade-offs on the surface. Because I think what a lot of managers do and what I did earlier in my management career was said, hey, we're really focused on results right now. And make whatever trade-offs you feel like you need to make. And they're like, okay, I guess, you know, screw the quality angle of this. And even for people who would normally act like more philosophical and analytical, they become very tactical very quickly. Like you can create that behavior in people. And this is why I say when you look at your team and you go, wow, we're really bending toward tactics, it may not be the collection of personalities. It might be environmental factors that me as a manager, I'm contributing to. And so sort of that self-examination to look at that and go, what kinds of stuff am I saying? What am I creating room for? What am I not creating room for? And so when we talk about walking those lines of like, okay, well, how do you walk the line? So you've assessed the situation. You have a clear idea of where you're over-focusing and under-focusing. You also, what I've learned is I can take a team and say, here are the constraints. So I don't just have to make the call myself. I can go, hey, team, mm-hmm. here are the constraints that we're under. We have this date that's not movable. We have these features. Let's sit down and break some stuff down and we'll figure out what can and can't fit in. And then we'll go, here's what we have. Here's it's estimated. Here's the, you know, you look down the list of things that we are, you know, the prioritized list of things. You've told me the priority of these things. We've taken a rough trade-off of priority to effort and listed them out. And here's the line that we're comfortable committing to. We think mm-hmm. we can have the, you know, you want 8 things. We think we can commit to these 2 things. Thing 3 is a stretch goal and 4 through 8 are right out and up to the quality standards that we're comfortable shipping at all. And with the assumption that we're going to have to own this thing after you ship it. Like this isn't getting thrown away because mm-hmm. it's never getting thrown away. Nobody ever throws their proof of concept software away. You put it in production.
I have. But that's a very concerted effort.
That requires a tremendous amount of discipline.
Yes. It's really hard to delete code.
Yeah.
Even to this day, I have branches in some code projects that I'm working on right now where I have branches that I haven't touched in 3 months that I haven't deleted because I'm going to get back to that at some point. Deleting code is really hard, but it's a very therapeutic process once you can do it. So I do highly recommend just delete code sometimes. Do a reset hard. If you've been working on something all afternoon, it's not working, reset hard, start over again the next day. That's my engineering tip from an engineering leader.
I think Ken Beck has a thing. I forget what he calls it, but it's like you write the test, you write the code, and if it fails a test, it deletes itself and you have to start over.
It's commit-driven development.
Yeah.
He runs test and commit or revert. Yeah. It, like, it literally has the bash command to run it. I've seen it.
It's interesting.
It's pretty hardcore.
I mean, yeah, I'm not sure I would live my life that way, like a quarter mile at a time or whatever, but that is pretty, that is a great way to, like, to practice that.
Now all I could think of is like Kent Beck in like a Vin Diesel shirt, like standing in front of a fast car.
Here's my last question that I want to ask around this is I want to come back to the tactical tornado personality type, that archetype, because we've talked about a lot of environmental factors a manager can do. But let's say you've got to kind of nail down, you like have that person and it is a problem. And I speak from experience because I know this person and I love this person. I'm so glad to have them on my team when I get this personality type on the team. But I also know this person is often slow to recognize that that personality type isn't always the right fit for every situation. And bringing that, and they're used to be treated like a Ferrari or a superstar. They're like, look, I have a 800 horsepower programming engine and you're trying to get me to go 25 miles an hour. And that's just not what I'm here for. And I'm wondering what you do. What does a manager do when they know they have this situation? You mentioned potentially move them into an agency type role. So one option is potentially like shift them into a position where that's just a more natural fit and you don't have to sort of ask them to bend themselves in any way. Do you have any other experience with other solutions to that?
One thing that I've done, so this is really context dependent, because sometimes you have people who have been rewarded in that scenario and they think they're amazing. They look at all of the kudos that they've accumulated over the years and all the things they've shipped, and they think they're awesome. And there's no amount of coaching you can do to help that person, generally speaking. I'm being very defeatist at that point of view, and that may just be scar tissue from having been in this scenario a time or two. But a lot of the times when you have somebody on your team that's like that, it's something that they're not necessarily self-aware of, and having conversations around that. So talking about tactical versus strategic programming and how they approach things and getting them thinking in that way. And then starting like a review of code, not in a code review sense, but like, how did this go? How did that go? Where do you think you are? How do you think this worked on this project with this team over here? Or having some of those conversations to try to bring awareness around it, I think is one possibility. It's kind of the AA thing about like the first step is admitting you have a problem.
Yeah.
It's like the first step to realizing that you are a tactical programmer or a tactical tornado is admitting that you are a tactical tornado. And that admission piece, not to be glib, is to recognize that that's even a thing you're doing. Because in the vast majority of situations that I've run across it, it's happening without somebody necessarily recognizing that it's happening. Like they don't have the context. And I think that as you start through that process, there's another problem that can arise that you could also find yourself in, again, depending on where in this continuum you find yourself, where you might be coming into a team that has people who have a very good tactical mindset, but get too bogged down in thinking big picture and don't try to reel it in and think about, okay, what practically do I need to do and what level of thought needs to go into this process. That's sort of that transition on that like long tail from developer, junior developer up to senior programmer. Somewhere along that line, as you move into a senior, and more often than not, you end up with senior in your title before this transition happens, you start to realize that you need to think more and plan more about what you're doing to prepare for the future. And if you don't have the right guidance in place, whether that's an engineering manager or a mentor or just a peer group to help correct you and point you in the right direction, you can end up overcorrecting yourself and being in this thing where you get paralyzed. I've seen developers, very, very talented developers, who, when tasked with working in a new framework, spend the first 2 weeks reading the entire framework to try to understand it.
Yeah.
I worked with one developer, and I'm definitely dating myself here in terms of technology, who literally went in and had read not only all of Backbone, but also _JS to understand how it all worked and how it all fit together so that they could build a prototype using Backbone. And that was that, like, they were too philosophical in the way they approached it. And that can be a backlash too, having to live with that process that was just thrown together. And, well, it was a prototype. I didn't mean for it to get deployed to 1,000 users.
Yeah, and I definitely know people. I would say those people generally, if your tendency is to read the source code of an entire framework before you write your first line of code in it, you probably have that more analytical mindset anyway. You know, like I know that's an archetype I'm familiar with, and you feel like you're getting kind of stuck together with a developer that is the often the sort of tactical, like, focus person who's like, oh, I saw 8 minutes of a tutorial, then I was like, ah, I'm bored, like, and I just started building, and now here's the thing. And it's like, it follows, it's a new framework, right? So they follow no conventions, no idioms. They like bring existing knowledge, and they wrote whatever they were writing before now in Backbone, or whatever they wrote their Backbone in Ember, or their Ember in React, or whatever, right? They just bring whatever they feel comfortable into the next thing, and then you go, oh, I see, this is PHP and Ruby.
Yeah.
I'm familiar. Like, and you did ship something. You did ship it. I mean, we'll give you that. So I would say the other thing that I would hope to do with some of these more tactical people, if they are causing problems and they're not aware of it, you kind of have to explain to them the costs and consequences they aren't seeing. Mm-hmm. So it's like, do you understand that one of the consequences is that other people on the team who like to ship things can't? Because you're soaking up all of the shipping on the team, and they're busy kind of like coming after you and writing the documentation that you're not writing, and doing the customer research that you're not doing, and doing the, you know, doing the process. This isn't free. Like, what you're doing isn't free. And if that's a conversation we have as a team, and it's like, no, I prefer that type of work and you prefer this type of work, so like that's a fair contract or whatever, I still would push back on that a little bit and say, hey, we should all be doing the various parts of the job, and some of us may prefer parts of it or other parts of it, but like everybody should be able to do, you know, end to end, ship something and understand the consequences of shipping something. Mm-hmm. But being able to explain to somebody who's in that situation, like, there are actual real world consequences to bringing that mentality. And one of them is that you might have career ambitions and goals. Like, let's, you know, hopefully as a manager, you know what those are. And my guess is for those people, their career ambition. Now, this has actually been, I'm wrong about this in some cases, I know, but it's likely that their career ambition is more than to be a senior developer until they retire. Now, I have known people whose career ambition is to be a senior developer until they retire, and God bless them. But I would probably classify that person as like in the minority. It's fun to write code, but feeling sort of like this is the level at which I'm going to contribute to my team for the rest of my career. By the time you're like year seven of your career, probably I would imagine people want more than that. And you can pretty much explain to somebody how that's going to hold them back. Like, you could be a senior developer for life and probably earn a good living until you retire. And I literally know people that have done that and are like right at the cusp of retirement as a senior dev, and they're deliriously happy with their life choices. You know, like, it is a valid way to choose to live your life, but you got to go in eyes open. Like, that person was like, I don't want to learn anything new. I'm done. Like, I'm good at shipping code in this language, in this framework, in this way, and I'm good. Like, my goal is to finish this and write out the last, you know, 24 months of my career so I can retire. And I'm like, that's great for me to know. Like, I know exactly what to do with you now. Yeah. And we've had a really great working relationship. But if you have higher ambitions than that, and you find yourself as like this tactical, you know, if you're just a pure tactician, you're going to miss on opportunities. Mm-hmm. And so you get to, as a manager, you get to sort of elucidate some of those opportunities they might miss out on.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We talked about this a little bit earlier, and I think you just hit it from a slightly different angle. I talked about like one of the jobs as a manager is to like communicate the cost of the decisions to the rest of the company. And you've taken that and talked about the communication in, and it's the same thing. It's communicate the cost of what you're doing and the decisions you're making, both as an individual developer to the team, but also to provide the context of what that impact is for the broader company. So like, yes, it may be a good thing to just throw something up, but here's the problems that we're going to run into with these clients that are going to create problems and strains with relationships that may mean when we get to the end of the year and we're looking at a renewal that now that's a more strained process than it needs to be, because this thing that's really important to them didn't have the due diligence that it needed, or the inverse of they just need something. Like, it yeah. really doesn't matter if it's perfect and it's going to last. They're okay with having something that they can iterate on. And this is a feature that we know we can release as beta for 6 months if we need to, and iterate to get to the place that we want it to be. But it's better to have it and have something in those interim 6 months than to wait the 6 months and have the fully fleshed out product.
Yeah. I'm increasingly convinced that the job of a manager is to largely take things that are often undiscussed and invisible and make them visible and discussed and raise these trade-offs that often happen suboptimally with very little context and information and jam so much context into them that smart people, the best people to make the decisions with those in that context, can make that trade-off. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's only so much you could do for an engineering team that makes informed bad decisions, but like, that's not usually my experience. Is usually people want to make good decisions, but they don't have the context necessary to do so. Mm-hmm. And if they knew that's what customers really valued and they actually give a crap about the customers, they will make those kinds of decisions and trade-offs autonomously. Mm-hmm. And then you do less and less over time because you've created a pipeline for that context.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. And the corollary on the business side is there are very few CEOs who actually their goal is to burn through their development teams. They recognize the cost of hiring.
I've met them.
They do exist. I'm not saying they don't exist, but they thankfully tend to be fewer than the norm. The norm actually want to have a sustainable, healthy company. And they just need the context to know that this is good or this is bad, or this is a positive or negative, or which way it's going to affect it. And that you can give your sociopath CEO who just wants to burn through people as quickly as possible and go hire another batch. You can give them all the ammunition and hopefully update your resume in the interim.
Yeah, I think that's really great. It reminds me that it is possible to do a good job as a manager, even though sometimes it feels elusive. And one of those things is, are you giving people the context to make higher and higher quality decisions, mm-hmm. both the executive team that are making decisions about what, you know, what's happening with the technical product and the technical direction, and individuals on the team? Like, do they have the context to contribute meaningfully to that? And that's not directly measurable that I can think of. I'm sure people will have ideas, but you can kind of have a sense if that's of that getting better, and that feels good. I've noticed that as a manager, and it feels good. Yeah. Well, I think that's probably a good place to wrap up. And this wound up being a really fun conversation just off like one key phrase that I was like, wait, what is that? You're going to have to explain this to me. So thanks for teaching me about tactical tornadoes. And I've definitely recognized the patterns and have some new ideas about what to go do about it. And I hope people listening do as well.
Awesome.
For those of you that are listening, you can keep submitting your topic ideas and suggestions. We will get to them all, I promise, at some point. We are at Managing Up Show on Twitter, and you can get each of us individually. I am at TaViking on Twitter.
And I am TSwiceGood most everywhere.
And as always, we love it when you rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify. We do check those periodically, and it's really fun to see. And please, please hit us with all 5 of those stars. And we will see you again next time, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us.
See ya.